For our blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service brings you... The Indie Week, read by John Fetterson. Our issue this week is dated October the 20th of 2021. Thank you, musicians. As you may know in the audience, we're broadcasting this week from that place, you know, right, that, just around that corner, that is the pine trees and the mailbox painted green. Anyway, that place. Our violinist and the grand piano had a bit of a time finding us. Then, of course, there's a still bit left over from the mudslides. So kudos to you folks, and we'll find you a pulley after the end of the broadcast. Thank you very much. We better get on to our issue today. And we'll begin right with our news, this one by Anna Mudd, called Deadly Deficiency, with rising overdoses and a flawed distribution system. A national naloxone shortage could lead to thousands of deaths. It was New Year's Eve. Devon Lyall sat in the back bedroom of her drug dealer's house. Her thin fingers fumbled with the syringe. Her fingers weren't the only frail thing about her. In the past 4 months, she had lost about 40 pounds, leaving her practically skin and bones. She was using Opana, a strong narcotic, melting the small circular pills into a liquid that she could inject. As the dregs of 2012 trickled into the new year, Lyall didn't have much hope. It was as if her life was ticking away as quickly as the seconds remaining before midnight. She was shaking, chills running through her body, yet she was so hot she felt like she was on fire. She kept injecting, hoping it was the relief her body needed. She woke up later, lying in a hospital bed. Her mother and father stood over her. She wasn't sure when or how she had gotten there. Lyall had overdosed. The drug dealer had called her mother, who rushed her to Wilkes Medical Center. They made it in time for doctors to give Lyall the reversal drug, naloxone, saving her life. Lyall said, "I remember in that moment feeling very helpless, but relieved. I was so glad I wasn't in that house anymore, and that maybe I had an opportunity to do something different. It was the first time in a long time that I thought maybe I can get help." She began the new year in the ICU for 7 days, a regular room for 10 more, and detox for 14 after that. Naloxone is a drug that blocks the nervous system's opiate receptors. It's most commonly used for drug overdoses. Narcan is a well-known brand name. In August, Pfizer halted production of its single-dose injectable naloxone due to a manufacturing issue. This causes issues as buyers' organizations distribute the naloxone to many grassroots harm reduction coalitions across the state. Dr. Naburun Dasgupta, drug and infectious disease scientist at UNC's Gillings School of Public Health, and others, estimate this interruption would result in about 1 million fewer doses, which could lead to as many as 18,000 avoidable overdose deaths. In 2012, the year Devon overdosed, naloxone and overdose kits weren't common in clinics, harm reduction coalitions, or other local organizations. Hardly any individual had them on hand. In a way, Devon was fortunate. She had a dealer who called her mother, and her mother responded. Many who overdosed at the time weren't as lucky. Now, naloxone is more accessible on pharmacy shelves, part of local syringe exchange programs, and often in first responders' hands. This access is crucial, especially as opioid overdose deaths rose to an all-time high in North Carolina in 2020. The change is largely a result of North Carolina's 2016 naloxone standing order, which allows pharmacists to dispense naloxone to those who need it and for community distribution. But addiction recovery experts say the standing order is not doing enough to blunt the rapid rise of opioid addiction. Dasgupta says there's a third tier of programs around the state that rely on other programs to purchase naloxone for them. So these are sponsored programs, programs run by people of color, serving people of color, and they are ones that don't have the official paperwork to buy and purchase naloxone, but have the really critical infrastructure to get it to where it needs to go. Getting naloxone to those local harm reduction groups is critical because this is often where active users who are most at risk go for naloxone. The standing order only covers distribution, not purchasing. Pharmaceutical companies producing naloxone require a prescription. This is where the nuances of the North Carolina's order stand in the way of easily getting naloxone to the organizations where it is most effective. Thus, Gupta says, the standing order, it's kind of a sham. Our legislature came up with a piecemeal, almost useless version of a law that created this standing order, then feel like they've done something and washed their hands of it. What would have really helped us is for these smaller programs to be able to order naloxone directly from pharmaceutical distributors. With rising overdoses, a flawed standing order, and a Pfizer shortage, North Carolina faces what could be a nightmare. Louise Vincent is the executive director of the NC Urban Survivors Union, a grassroots Greensboro group working to support and assure safety for opioid users in the community through syringe exchanges and by providing naloxone. She says, if I didn't have naloxone, I couldn't go to work. I couldn't look someone in the face and tell them I don't have naloxone and send them to die, because you're literally sending someone off to die if you don't have it. This reality landed on national consultant Robert Suarez's doorstep at Urban Survivors just a few weeks ago. A young woman ran into the center screaming. Her friend was overdosing in her car right outside the clinic. Suarez grabbed two bottles of naloxone, ran outside, opened the passenger side door, climbed on top of the overdosing man, and administered the life-saving drug. After he injected it, Suarez said he gave him mouth-to-mouth during the 4 minutes it took the naloxone to work. 4 minutes is an eternity when someone isn't breathing on their own, Suarez says. A month into Pfizer's naloxone shortage, the Urban Survivors Union supplies remain sufficient for now. But the fear of coming up short is pervasive. Vincent says, I'm acutely aware there's a shortage and I want to be mindful. I cannot run out. I will not run out. Bottom line is I won't run out. There's expired naloxone that I've already figured out how to access. We're pretty scrappy people. I'm going to find it. Another way harm reduction groups are coping with this shortage is by getting naloxone from larger organizations across the state with the ability to purchase from other pharmaceutical distributors. One of these groups is helping provide naloxone is Project Lazarus in Wilkes County. They have a medical director able to order the drug. Fred Benson, executive director and founder, says, we've worked with what stock we have, and every time we've looked at getting naloxone, it wasn't just for ourselves. I've given Louise Vincent naloxone. I've given it to Twin Cities Harm Reduction. Branson explains that studies show that people who go to a pharmacy for naloxone are usually family members or friends of a user, rather than the user themselves. Branson says, within the harm reduction circle, there is a huge concern. There never has been the full access that's necessary to make the difference naloxone can. Any reduction from what was already not sufficient is going to create major problems. Tracy Collins, a waitress in Greensboro, relies on the Urban Survivors Union for naloxone. She says, the circle of people that I travel in wouldn't go anywhere else but Urban Survivors. They don't want to walk into places like CVS or Walgreens because those people are so judgmental. In August, Coins saved someone overdosing right in front of her with the naloxone she had in hand. She was with a group of people at a friend's house, and they were all doing heroin. Suddenly, one man curled up, his body as tense as a rubber band, stretched to its limits, his arms and legs locked up. Coins looked around the room and realized no one had any idea how to help. I carry naloxone with me all the time if I can. The only place I get it is through Urban Survivors. Coins gave him naloxone and mouth-to-mouth until he came to. local harm reduction agencies acknowledge that there are people who are going to use drugs. By providing naloxone and hosting syringe exchanges, they give these people the option to have a safer experience. After Lyle's near-fatal New Year's Eve, she got clean. She gradually got her life back, her house, her kids, and she reconnected with her family. Today, she's the founder and executive director of Wilkes Recovery Revolution. Wilkes Recovery focuses on helping people overcome addiction and is a harm reduction center, working to assure users are safe, distributing naloxone, and trying to decrease stigma. She says syringe exchange programs are truly the people that are boots on the ground. We're the ones intersecting with people who use drugs and serving them on a daily basis, yet we are the last to get naloxone, when I think it should probably be the other way around. So if there's a shortage, then we're definitely hurting at the grassroots level as a syringe exchange. Pfizer expects its shortage to continue through February 2022, leaving harm reduction groups to continue relying on sources whose naloxone supplies are diminishing. Lyle says she had a wonderful life before her addiction. A supportive upper-middle-class upbringing, a good job and family of her own. When she slipped down some icy stairs at a ski resort, shattering her ankle, she had no idea the pain medicine she would be prescribed would be the start to a crippling addiction. Now Lyle reflects on pulling herself out of the depth of her addiction, how difficult this was, and how lucky she was to get naloxone in time to save her life. At Wilkes Recovery Center, she wants to give people this same chance. She says, "When I moved back home, my mission was to give other people the opportunities that I had. I understand that I was a privileged person, and not everybody gets those same options and opportunities, and that I was very lucky to have." Next article by Nicole Kagan, produced through Indie Week partnership with Ninth Street Journal, which is produced by journalism students at Duke University. Say his name. Traffic court is full. People sit chin in hand, eyelids heavy. Some stomp out of the courtroom, then return a few minutes later. Others grimace, checking their watches and rolling their eyes. And some are not so silent. "What the F, bruh? I got places to be." It's noon on a recent Wednesday at Durham County Courthouse, and even Judge Pat Evans wants to get a move on. She sits at the bench in her robe, with long black hair, gray at the roots, pulled tight in a ponytail. She sticks to a script. Call a name, hear a case, make a ruling, repeat. The defendants don't stick to the same script. They bring the wrong papers. They go to the wrong place, and they come late, or not at all. Of those who make it, most accept blame for their tickets, pay a fine, and get out. Few contest their citations, and fewer win. On this day, September 22, Anthony Rashad Floyd chose to be one of the few, and soon the courtroom would understand why. Floyd, a Durham resident, arrives in court on time in a yellow polo shirt, black jeans, and loafers. He appears to be in his 40s. As he waits in the gallery, yellow light reflects off his diamond earrings. 3 months ago, Floyd was driving down Route 70, on his way to J.J. Fish and Chicken in Durham for an early dinner. It was 5 p.m., and there was heavy traffic. Bumper to bumper, he says. On this much, Floyd and the deputy who cited him agree. Beyond that, their stories conflict. On the stand, Floyd says that when his turn came, he put on his blinker and moved into the center lane. Then he said he decided he could wait to eat, so he signaled and merged back out to head home. That's when Deputy T. Hatch pulled him over. "You gotta be kidding," says a voice in the courtroom as Floyd tells his story. "Can't believe he took this to trial." Centerline violations rarely make it to court. Most people prefer a small fine to a morning in traffic court. Floyd is not most people. He will say in an interview after the hearing, "It's about principle. I didn't do anything wrong, and I'm not going to let an officer take advantage of me like I know they do." In May 2020, Floyd's first cousin was murdered in a Minneapolis street by a police officer who pinned him to the ground for more than 9.5 minutes till he stopped breathing. This cousin's name was George Floyd. When Anthony Floyd announces this to the court, those listening in the gallery don't believe him. Some laugh. "Yeah, right," says a voice in the back. Others remain quiet, unsure how to react. Anthony says that he and George were tight. After George's death, Anthony went to marches with family and yelled, "Say his name," with a fist in the air. He has photos of himself the day before the funeral, standing with George's attorney, Al Sharpton, and Joe Biden. He's still in disbelief about his cousin's death. He's also more uneasy around police. When Hatch pulled him over, Floyd's face got hot. He didn't know why he was being stopped. Hatch told him he didn't signal when he switched lanes. Floyd replied that he did and would fight this in court. "That's your right," Hatch said, before returning to his patrol car. Aside from a speeding ticket at age 16, Floyd's never been in trouble with the law. He knows his rights. "I was on point with everything," he says in court. "So far as being behind the wheel, I made sure that at all times, especially since what happened to my cousin, I follow all the rules. That's how I know for a fact I used my turn signal. The dash cam footage will show that. Where's the dash cam footage?" He asks this question 12 times in court. No one gives a clear answer. "That's a whole process," Hatch says. At George Floyd's trial, video was a star witness. Jurors watched film from cell phones, body cams, dash cams, surveillance cams. Video footage brought justice for George. Anthony wants it to do the same for him, but Hatch doesn't want to deal with the process. It seems that Judge Evans doesn't either. Once Hatch and Anthony are done testifying, she rules. "Your cousin has nothing to do with this matter," she says. "The citation stands." Anthony stays still for a moment. He turns to look at the people in the gallery behind him, but they avoid eye contact. He looks back at the judge, but she's moved on. When Anthony stands and heads out of the courtroom, people turn their heads to watch him leave. He walks down the hall outside alone, mumbling to himself. He talks about the dash cam footage. He wonders if he needs to come back to court. He realizes he forgot to mention the van in front of him that did the same thing. He didn't know if he owes, or what he owes, or how to pay. He says he does know he did nothing wrong. He knows that he fought for justice, and, quote, "and it felt good." Joe Killian now writes Hush Hush Homecoming. When Walter Hussman returned to UNC Chapel Hill last week, he hoped to begin mending relations with the journalism school that bears his name. But that proved to be difficult, given the mega donors lobbying against the hiring of Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones. The episode, which culminated in Hannah-Jones declining a tenure offer this summer in favor of Howard University, generated national headlines. It also sparked an ongoing debate about race, journalism, academic freedom, and donor influence at the university. It strained the relationship between Hussman and this journalism school, prompting faculty and students to consider deeper questions about whether his values align with those of the school. This week, as the school begins its search for a new dean and faces evaluation by an accrediting association, Hussman continues to stir controversy. Hussman, a UNC alum and Arkansas-based media magnate, hoped to meet Friday with members of the journalism faculty. Stephen King, an associate professor of emerging technologies at UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media, was asked by Dean Susan King to try to put together a meeting at which Hussman could talk to faculty members about these issues. Stephen King and Susan King are not related. On Monday, Stephen King sent an email to his colleagues saying he didn't believe that was possible. Quote, "For various reasons, I do not feel we're able to assemble a representative panel that could effectively communicate the diverse and passionate views of our faculty for a meeting this Friday." One of those various reasons, a number of key faculty members invited to the meeting declined to attend. Others wanted to attend, but weren't invited. King wrote, I've recommended that Dean King and Mr. Hussman postpone the discussion, and I suggested we take a different approach for Friday. I'm inviting Mr. Hussman and the school administration, Susan King, Charlie Tuggle, Heidi Hennig Kaminsky, and Danita Morgan to my lab to work through a proper process that will facilitate fruitful discussion that hopefully builds a relationship between the faculty and our named donor. We intend to leave the meeting with a roadmap for working through our differences that is agreeable to faculty and Mr. Hussman. Deb Aikat, an associate professor at the Journalism School, is a member of the university's Faculty Executive Committee. He has been outspoken about what he says was Hussman's inappropriate interference in the hiring of Hannah Jones, as well as Hussman's desire to exert undue influence on the school's direction as its named donor. That candor has made the academic environment uncomfortable for Aikat. He was one of several professors targeted by the university after Hussman's donor agreement was leaked to the News and Observer in the wake of that Hannah Jones controversy. Though Aikat and other professors didn't have access to the document, university officials surreptitiously read their emails and questioned the professors about the contents. This intrusion led Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, to write letters in protest and spurred resentments among many of the journalism school's faculty. The way the school is now handling what Aikat calls the hush-hush Hussman homecoming is just making the situation worse, he said. He said he wanted to participate in the meeting. I emailed the dean to say I would like to attend. I got no reply. It is clear Hussman and school and university administrators want to work through those differences. Hussman pledged $25 million to the school in 2019, which led to it being named for him, but he has yet to donate much of the money. Under the terms of the donor agreement, the school won't receive about half of it until Hussman and his wife die. It's less clear whether most of the school's faculty members, students, and alumni would like to mend the relationship, or, as an increasing number are now suggesting, they would prefer to sever ties with Hussman altogether. The Dean's Cabinet this week issued a survey to full-time journalism and media faculty members gauging what they might want from a meeting with Hussman. An analysis of the survey by Heidi Hennig Kaminsky, Senior Associate Dean for Graduate Studies, found a mixed reaction. Some wanted a dialogue with Hussman, while others said they didn't see the point and thought it might be counterproductive. She wrote in her analysis, in their responses, faculty identified what they would like to be able to share with the donor in the meeting. Responses can be grouped into four areas. 1. Information about the rigor of the tenure hiring process at UNC. 2. New thinking about the future of journalism ethics. 3. Broader information about the non-journalism areas of the school and the values reflected therein. And 4. The damage faculty believe has done to the school reputation. An anonymized sampling of faculty responses reviewed by Policy Watch featured questions about how Hussman sees his relationship to and role within the school. Those responses also asked whether Hussman understands that his interference in the Hannah Jones hiring was inappropriate and harmful, and if he would commit to abstaining from future hiring decisions. Several faculty members said they wanted a public acknowledgement of wrongdoing and apology from Hussman, along with a statement from school leaders that such interference from donors won't happen in the future. Most of those who took the survey said they would favor an optional, moderated meeting between full-time faculty and Hussman, with an optional invitation for staff leadership to attend. But faculty members who spoke with Policy Watch this week said they aren't sure any meeting can be productive if it doesn't address an overarching problem with Hussman. As part of his donor agreement, Hussman's core values of journalism are now displayed on a wall in the lobby of the Journalism School home at Carroll Hall. The agreement calls for them to be etched in stone. Though faculty were not consulted on those core values or how they would be displayed, Hussman has repeatedly asserted that the school has adopted these values as its own. In a July survey, an overwhelming majority of faculty members rejected the notion that Hussman's values represented the school and said the school should establish its own values statement. Faculty at the school and journalism experts across the country take issue with portions of Hussman's core values statement. Among them are the assertion that, quote, impartiality is the greatest source of credibility, and that while the pursuit of truth is, quote, a noble goal, truth is, quote, not always apparent or known immediately. Historians and journalism scholars, including some of UNC's most prominent journalism alumni, point out that those sentiments have been used throughout journalism history to preserve the societal status quo and minimize the voices of women and racial, ethnic, and religious minorities. In practice, faculty have argued Hussman used his core values statement as a litmus test to argue against hiring Hannah Jones, a prominent UNC alum and highly decorated investigative journalist. Hussman had objected to her opinion writing on racial issues such as reparations for black Americans and her Pulitzer Prize-winning work on the 1619 Project. Kate Shepard, a teaching assistant professor in the journalism school, has been working on a process for determining the school's values. In an August meeting, the faculty proposed a plan for gathering feedback and a timeline for acting on it this spring. Shepard says, I have no problem with Walter Hussman's value statement as a statement of Walter Hussman's values, what he prints in the newspapers, his words. But there's an ongoing conversation, and there always is, about values. They shift. They evolve. This week, a team from the Accrediting Council on Education in Journalism and Mass Communications was on campus, meeting with journalism students and faculty at the school. Though the school was re-accredited, Dean Susan King shared in an email to faculty that the school is, quote, out of compliance on the diversity standard. Dean King says he was told the school would have sailed through had the accreditation taken place as scheduled this time last year. But since that time, concerns and controversy over the botched hire and Hussman's influence have altered some perceptions at the school. Quote, the team found angry faculty and what was described as a culture of complaint, wrote the dean. They found faculty had deep worry about Walter Hussman and questioned gift agreement and donor relations. They found both students and faculty exhausted from the Hannah Jones controversy. And King wrote, according to the team's analysis, reconciling the expectation of all faculty without damaging our culture is the challenge for us as a school. And they told me that the reason we failed diversity was because of culture. They said they wanted to send a message to faculty that we often talk the talk and perhaps don't walk the walk. They indicated some faculty don't feel welcomed, and faculty and students of color feel burdened. Dean King wrote, students of color said, we know the words, but not the deeds. The accreditation team also called out the school's lack of diversity among adjunct professors, King wrote, who teach the foundational courses in the school. The team suggested the school examine its curriculum and ensure diversity is at the heart of every course. Dean King did not respond to emails from Policy Watch this week. ICAT said the accreditor's assessment of the school's diversity problem is not a surprise, saying, we talk about diversity. We make a much vaunted spirit, but our school keeps ignoring true diversity and inclusion. The people of color in our school, faculty and students, are feeling the strain. We have to shout four times for them to hear what we are saying, what we are all about. The faculty meeting with Hussman and select faculty is a good example, Eichert said. Everyone Stephen King identified as part of the meeting in his email is white, Eichert said. It was only once faculty members asked whether a member of the school's access, belonging, inclusion, diversity, and equity group should be a part of the meeting that King asked for a representative from it. ACAT said that it doesn't occur to someone that that is a problem, that in is itself a problem. The focus should not be on the culture of complaint in the school, said ACAT, but the substance of the complaints. Faculty and students of color are pointing out a deeper problem within the school that was put on a national stage when a wealthy white conservative donor did battle over hiring an eminently qualified and nationally renowned black journalist at the school, ACAT said, and in the end, that donor got what he wanted. ACAT said, I am concerned that he feels as though he has won, and now he is returning to campus. And maybe he will meet with some faculty and some administrators, and then he can go back to Arkansas and say, hey, I met with the faculty. Everything is fine. Everything is not fine, ACAT said. We know that. Now, as you could possibly tell, that story was initially published online at North Carolina Policy Watch. Now from Durham, Tomasi McDonald's column, Violence Interrupted. 1 year ago, on October 22nd, former gang member David Johnson told Durham City Council members that he was a victim of violence, that he had encouraged others to acts of violence, and that he had committed violence in the past. Today, Johnson supervises Durham's core violence program that's known as Bull City United, BCU, the county-funded team of violence interrupters and outreach workers are trained to resolve outbreaks of violence on the streets before they happen. BCU started working in gun-plagued neighborhoods in 2016 with the goal of approaching violence as a public health issue, not unlike cholera or influenza outbreaks. Johnson thinks the key to changing high-risk individuals' behavior is having someone who will believe in them, who believes they can change, and helps them to realize that a life of crime is not the only life. And he says, a lot of people don't know that. I didn't know that. This program has changed my life completely. It saved my life. It saved my kids' life. I had spent my life in prison since I was 16. I started with BCU as a guy, recruiting others. Now I'm a supervisor, trying to get others like me. According to a Durham City-County interlocal agreement to expand BCU to 4 gunfire-prone neighborhoods, the local initiative is modeled after Cease Fire, an anti-violence program that was originally developed in 2000 and implemented in Chicago neighborhoods where there were high incidents of shootings and gun murders. The ceasefire model relies on data-driven strategies normally associated with disease control by detecting and interrupting conflicts, identifying and treating the highest-risk individuals, and changing social norms in the communities where they live. Durham's interlocal agreement states, after continued investment over the decade, along with focused strategies, the program evaluators noted a decline in neighborhoods where the ceasefire model was implemented. Durham's model will celebrate its 5th anniversary next month. BCU views gun violence through the lens of public health, a deadly epidemic, with clusters breaking out in at-risk neighborhoods capable of spreading to other vulnerable communities. Johnson leads a team of 6 who have been working in the city's most violent communities to change the mindsets of young people who are at high risk of committing violence by mediating conflicts before the incidents escalate. The initiative also offers a battery of services from mental health to substantive employment initiatives to cure the gun violence epidemic. Last year, BCU reported that between March 1 and September 12th of 2020, 556 shootings were reported throughout the city. Only 63 occurred in BCU's target areas. McDougal's Terrace, which in 2015 was deemed the most violent neighborhood in the city, and Southside, the city's second most violent neighborhood. Johnson told the city council during last year's meeting work session in October, give me 100 people and I can change the violence trends in Durham. In January, City Council reviewed the overall decline in gun violence in McDougal Terrace and Southside and then voted to give the county up to $935,000 to hire 18 more people and expand the cure violence model to four other areas in the city that are also perennially bedeviled by gunplay. The new target areas of treatment are Cornwallis Road, a section of Southside that was not part of the original target area, Oxford Manor, along with Liberty and Elm Streets. Durham City Council member Mark Anthony Middleton this week told the Indy that he has called for and championed the expansion of the BCU initiative as a non-policing element of a multifaceted, comprehensive approach to addressing Durham's scourge of gun violence. And he said, "Their work is challenging and potentially dangerous and isn't for everyone. While it's customary to measure the efficacy of tax-funded initiatives with metrics and outcomes, a unique element of BCU's mission is to intercept and eliminate incidents before they happen. I call it the work of headline prevention." Durham Mayor Steve Shule told Indy that he recently walked through McDougal Terrace with BCU staffers who are working in the neighborhood and with several of the new people who have been hired to work in other communities. The mayor said, I got a chance to talk to them for quite a while and to hear ambitions for their work. I continue to think that this is a really important strategy to break the cycle of violence that we're seeing in Durham right now. On October 30th, city and county leaders will receive their first quarterly report from BCU to determine if the former gang members trained and deployed to stop gun violence in the neighborhoods where they live have been effective in persuading their neighbors to stop shooting one another in some of the city's most impoverished communities. While talking with Indy earlier this week, Wendy Jacobs, co-chair of the Durham County Board of Commissioners, offered a couple of caveats about this upcoming report. The county has not yet filled all 18 positions. And, quote, "This is challenging work that takes special skills with people who need to be trusted community members from the neighborhoods where they are working." Jacobs noted that the new hires will undergo extensive training and says she believes in the evidence-based model of resolving conflicts and connecting people to the resources they need, be it help with mental health and substance abuse or finding good jobs. And she added, "These approaches are not quick fixes. This is about investing in relationships and the people in our community trying to address the root causes of gun violence and treating it as a public health issue rather than a law enforcement issue." At first glance, BCU's violence interrupters don't appear to have many success stories to share about stopping gun violence. Following shootings last month that killed three people, including two 20-year-olds on NC Central University's campus, Durham police reported 32 homicides for the year. Last year, there were 22 during the same time period and 26 in 2019. Likewise, there have been reports of 579 shootings this year. Last year, there were 688, and in 2019, 493. Gun violence in the city has probably been exacerbated by an increase in firearm thefts, particularly from vehicle break-ins, police reported last month. Investigators say there were 261 firearms reported stolen to the police department between January and August, a 4% increase during the same period last year. More than 50% of the weapons were taken from vehicles, and the majority of the vehicles were unlocked and parked in residential neighborhoods. But last month, Durham Police spokeswoman Cammy Michael told Indy that gun violence this year has been on a downward trajectory. Shooting incidents in the city have decreased by 16%, while the number of people shot has gone down by 12% when compared to the same time period last year. Last year, on November 12, Shewell and former police chief Sarah Lynn Davis hosted a press conference to address the rising tide of gun violence after a drive-by shooting killed a 15-year-old boy, Anthony Adams, on East Main Street. Davis noted the emergence of another troubling trend. The majority of the city's gun offenders are juveniles. Johnson, the BCU supervisor, pointed to why young people are becoming involved with deadly gunplay. He explained, "They're not in school because of this pandemic. 14 and 15-year-olds are not in school. Their parents are working, so they're not going to school at all. They're out here on the street." Supervision and guidance of BCU falls under the purview of Joanne Pierce, Durham County's General Manager of Health and Well-Being. During last year's City Council work session and before their work in January, Pierce sounded a cautionary note, telling the elected leaders to pay attention to the systemic issues at the root of the gun violence, including racism and divestment in black neighborhoods, saying BCU intervention cannot solve a crisis generations in the making. This is not about the moral failings of individuals. It's about the moral failings of institutions that have allowed these issues to fester. In his call for collaborating with the county to fund BCU, Middleton said, "The city is facing an optical challenge in the eyes of Durham residents who are wondering why their elected leaders are not responding to gun violence with a greater sense of urgency." And he said, "There's nothing more important that a government can do than protecting its people. Gunfire is going to go off in the city tonight, whether anyone is hit or not." The BCU presentation to the City Council members pointed to studies that indicate serious or fatal emergency room visits are typically the second visit from the same gunshot victim, and that up to 45% of patients treated for violent injuries will be injured again or die of fatal injuries within 5 years. Between January and June of 2019, there were 60 participants being treated by the BCU model. Many of the participants had multiple risk factors, including gang involvement, a prior criminal history, street activity associated with violence, and they carried a firearm. The at-risk individuals' participation in the BCU model resulted in 91% finding employment, while 79% showed gun-related behavior change. The program also reported that 87% of the conflicts that were either personal altercations or gang involved were, quote, successfully resolved. But for a great many residents, BCU's previous success, however admirable, is not enough. For the past several years, stopping the scourge of deadly gun violence has been a top, albeit failing, priority for Durham's elected officials, activists, and faith-based leaders alike. It's the Damocles sword that hangs over conversations about defunding police or calls for more police on the streets. Indeed, with the continuing death of so many African-American men and boys by other black men and boys, it's a challenge to define a low point in the bloodbath. It should have been in 2019, when 9-year-old Zion Person was killed in a drive-by shooting on August 18th while riding in the back seat of his aunt's Ford with other children for a late-night treat of snow cones. It could have been last year in July when 10 people, including 3 children, were shot in a single night. One of those children, 12-year-old Tyvion Ty McLean, died from a gunshot wound to the head. Johnson told Councilmember Middleton, who asked if BCU's team can get to younger gang members who have no code and are led by so-called original gangsters who are as young as 19, "They're very, very reachable. With the right people, everybody's reachable. I would recruit the highest-ranking guy in Cornwallis Road Apartments that's trying to get out of the life, and he's going to take care of the little kids he knows. I know the head Crip in Bragtown. I know the head of Blood in Cornwallis. I know the head Crip in Cornwallis. You got Bloods and Crips in Cornwallis. I can reach them with the right staff." The last long article is by Jasmine Gallup, and it's about the cost of housing in the Triangle. It's the first part of a two-part series. On a quiet street near downtown Raleigh, the percussive crack of a hammer on nail rises over the oak trees on Newbern Avenue, construction workers are erecting a dozen new townhomes. Less than a mile away from the steps of his lifelong home, 64-year-old Isaac White Sr. can hear them remaking his neighborhood. He tells the Indy, "I never thought I would see a $500,000 houses in this neighborhood for sale. They're telling me now my house is worth $600,000 to $700,000. That's nothing to me because I don't plan on selling my house, but they're taxing me on it." White, who lives in the historically black community of Battery Heights, is one of the only original homeowners left on his block. Gentrification has forced out many of his neighbors who were unable to afford increased property taxes. His story is a familiar one. In recent years, Raleigh's already hot housing market has turned supernova, sending home values into the stratosphere and creating intense bidding wars. "As more people flock to the Triangle," says Samuel Gunter, executive director of the NC Housing Coalition, "builders can't keep up with the need for affordable homes." Raleigh was already short a few thousand homes when the coronavirus hit, raising the cost of construction and decreasing the supply even more. At the same time, Apple announced its new East Coast headquarters would be located in the Triangle, boosting demand. Realtor Cecilia Zubik says, "It's the perfect storm. I've seen personally a lot of people coming from California as well as from up north. Not all of that is because they want to live here. A lot of people are buying through LLCs as investors. 10% of purchases in the Raleigh area have been for investment, which is a big chunk. In the first 3 months of 2021, about 2,400 homes were sold in Raleigh and Durham. Of those, more than half were bought either by people from out of state or companies preying on this market to make a profit," states a report from the Triangle Business Journal. "Many are wealthy investors who buy houses and flip them for cash." The rising price of home sales has increased the assessed value of neighboring houses, which in turn increases the property taxes for homeowners such as White. He says, "That's the issue so many seniors are facing. You get older, you get on a fixed income, and then all of a sudden your taxes have doubled, some of them tripled. I shouldn't be burdened because you decided this is a good place to live. I know it's a good place to live all my life. That's why I've been living here." To White, the solution is simple. Stop raising property taxes. Wake County already offers some help to homeowners, says Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. She points to programs that give people tax relief based on age and income, such as the homestead exemption, which allows some low-income elderly residents to pay taxes on only about half their home's value. Not everyone in need qualifies for those programs, however. White, for example, just misses the age cutoff. Young and middle-aged homeowners who make below-average wages are also out of luck. One solution may be to offer more widespread help to homeowners affected by gentrification. Durham started a program earlier this month that gives long-time, low-income homeowners up to $750 to help pay their annual tax bill, regardless of age. Similar programs in Orange and Mecklenburg counties offer grants to people who have lived in the area for many years. Baldwin says the city is considering a proposal from One Wake, a nonprofit affordable housing advocate. The program would offer tax relief to people who have owned their homes for at least 10 years, earn less than 80% of the area median income, and who are currently paying more than 2% of their income toward property tax, say One Wake officials. The nonprofit is interested in developing a program with a city and county that could go on for decades, with financial assistance scaling up to match future property tax increases. If enacted, such a program would be the biggest in North Carolina, similar to one in Atlanta, that covers all increases in property tax for certain homeowners through 2030. As homeowners lobby for lower property taxes, some strained voices are also rising to help renters. Jamie Paulin, an eviction attorney based in Hillsborough, is one of the few people currently advocating for changes to the landlord-tenant law. She's asking the state legislature to lift the ban on rent control, allowing local governments to put big management companies in check. And she says, in California, one of the ways tenants are able to live is that there's only so much your rent can go up every year. In North Carolina, they've taken that away. Without rent control, low-priced apartments are disappearing, leaving many with no place to live. Landlords either raise the rent or renovate and sell their buildings to companies that seek wealthier tenants. In Wake County, 59% of apartments priced below $750 a month have been lost since 2010. In today's dollars, that's $940 a month, accounting for inflation. 40% of apartments priced below $1,000 a month, or this year, $1,250, have also vanished, according to county officials. For tenants looking to stay in their apartments, rent control is the obvious answer. Another solution may be giving renters the first right to purchase the building they live in when it goes up for sale. Such policies can help residents retain control of a community rather than large-scale investors. In Washington, D.C., tenants have the opportunity to buy their buildings and turn them into co-ops with the help of a low-interest loan program. The North Carolina legislature, however, is not on board with such progressive housing laws, and neither are local leaders. Baldwin says Raleigh officials aren't lobbying for those policies. Instead, they're asking the state to redevelop their underused property, like the former Rex Hospital. She and other city council members are focused on building more mixed-income housing. Large advocacy organizations, too, have held off lobbying the legislature for rent control. Some are waiting for state leaders more willing to lift the rent control ban, Gunter explains. They were expecting different results from the 2020 election, when Republicans held on to their majority in the General Assembly. Gunter says a large part of it is the political climate we're in and folks focusing on what they can do. It feels out of reach as a win. Today, the NC Housing Coalition is throwing its support behind a shorter-term solution, the renter's tax credit. The policy, similar to existing tax credits for homeowners, would allow certain low-income renters to deduct money from the taxes they pay each year, Gunter says. North Carolina is one of the 28 states that does not offer a renter's tax credit, but there are two nationwide proposals currently under consideration in the U.S. Senate. Keeping people in their homes isn't just a matter of offering them financial help. With property taxes rising so quickly, a one-time payment isn't enough to keep people housed, says Sonia Barnes, a Southeast Raleigh resident, advocating on behalf of her community. Officials also have to prevent affordable homes and apartments from being destroyed, upfitted, or redeveloped as market-rate housing. One way to prevent the loss of affordable housing is for local governments to buy property directly before it's sold to investors seeking a profit. In Durham, city officials are awarding federal money to the Durham Community Land Trust to buy homes and convert them into permanently affordable housing. After the Community Land Trust buys property, the nonprofit owns the land beneath the house and leases it back to the homeowner for a nominal monthly fee. By removing the cost of land, the trust can sell homes to people at up to 30% below market rate, putting them within the reach of cashiers or waiters. The strategy, which has worked in Seattle and Minnesota, is a way to create housing that remains affordable for decades, if not longer. That long-term affordability creates housing stability, which is key in preventing gentrification, says Sydney Betancourt, a housing advocacy organizer with the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. In San Francisco, a right-to-purchase policy has bolstered the efforts of nonprofits to preserve affordable housing. The law gives nonprofits first dibs on property up for sale. The policy came in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, when swaths of foreclosed homes were bought up by investment groups and turned into high-end rentals. A similar policy could be a powerful tool in North Carolina for the preservation of affordable housing. In the next 30 years, the Durham Community Land Trust has helped convert 280 homes into permanent affordable housing, but in order to truly make an impact, cities need to scale up these initiatives to cover thousands of homes, says Gunter. Similarly, Raleigh's narrow tax programs need to expand in order to make a dent in gentrification. Such widespread projects require tens of millions of dollars. Wake County may have taken the first big step earlier this month when commissioners created a $10.5 million fund to preserve affordable housing. The money will let the county buy properties before they're lost to the for-profit market, according to a news release. Wake County commissioners plan to grow the fund to $61 million with additional money from city and town councils, companies, and nonprofits. The Raleigh City Council will soon vote on whether to commit $4 million. For Gunter, it's ultimately a matter of whether local officials are willing to commit the amount of money needed to truly make a dent in the affordable housing crisis. Raleigh and other local governments are getting a big chunk of federal money this year, but how will they spend it? So far, the city has allocated $10 million toward affordable housing from the American Rescue Plan Act. Another $44 million is on the table and looks to be divided between housing, economic recovery, community health, and infrastructure. When it comes to affordable housing needs, however, the list is lengthy. In addition to new programs, the city has a backlog of repair needs to public housing, going back decades, Gunter says. And he adds, to the credit of the Durham City Council, the Raleigh City Council, they have acted. But all of this is a question of political will. What are you going to choose to tackle and tackle in scale? If this is it, there's more you could be doing. Well, unfortunately, I have to eliminate or not read three articles from the Indie Week this issue. One is on Ann Jamile, the musician, and their move to Durham and her upcoming audio release. Howard Kraft, the playwright, who got his start at NC Central, and a 10-day film festival in Kerry featuring films on refugees and immigrants. These three articles can be found at indieweek.com. To hear this show again, visit ncreadingservice.org. So, John Feddersen, thanks you again for listening to this week's production, Indie Week. So long.